Support for the legalization of marijuana is growing and more states are becoming weed friendly. I'm Tanzina Vega and we're talking about legalizing recreational weed today on The Takeaway for December 8th. We'll hear from someone who served in prison on a marijuana-related charge and how she feels now that it's fast becoming decriminalized.
The people who have the money never really felt the ravages that our communities still feel and that we still see when we go to poor communities that were hit hard by marijuana criminalization.
Plus, you're telling us your experiences.
I developed a back injury over this summer. I've been on disability, long-term disability ever since. And I use the marijuana to sleep at night.
And breakdancing is now officially an Olympic sport, and we get to see it in the 2024 Games. There's one thing that a majority of Americans are increasingly agreeing on, and that's legalizing marijuana. Nearly 68% of adults in the U.S. now support legalization, according to a recent Gallup poll, which is double the number of people who supported it back in 2001. In November, New Jersey, Arizona, Montana, and South Dakota joined 15 other states and Washington, D.C. when they voted in favor of legalizing recreational marijuana, and 36 states have already legalized medical marijuana. But the criminal justice inequities of past marijuana policies also can't be ignored. Marijuana is still considered a Schedule I drug alongside heroin at the federal level. And black and brown people, especially those from low-income communities, continue to be incarcerated because of marijuana convictions. But in a major shift last week, a majority of Democrats and a handful of Republicans in the House voted to federally decriminalize marijuana. With a bill called the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or the MORE Act. The bill probably won't make it past the Senate, but it does set a new precedent for how seriously the federal government is taking the issue. I've got Dan Adams on the line. He's the cannabis reporter for the Boston Globe. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Tanzina.
Also is with us is Maritza Perez, the director of the Office of National Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance in Washington. Maritza, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, you have what would arguably be one of the most interesting jobs in journalism as a cannabis reporter for the Globe. As your reporting has evolved, why are so many people in support of recreational marijuana specifically?
It is a great job title. Thank you. People have a lot of different reasons for supporting legalization. It's an issue that truly has bipartisan appeal. And if you look at the polls, as you mentioned, they show really consistently almost 70% of Americans are in favor of full legalization, and more than 90% support medical marijuana legalization. And the number of people who support prohibition, keeping this prohibition in place, fewer than 10%. So some folks are coming at it from more of a libertarian angle. Some folks are coming at it from more of a progressive angle, from that social justice angle that you just mentioned.
I'm going to talk a little bit about breaking those different angles down. But Maritza, we heard at the very top of the segment, one of the things that drew me to this is that the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or the MORE Act, was recently passed by the House. What's the difference between decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana? Let's start there, Maritza.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So we call this a decriminalization bill because what it would do is deschedule marijuana, which means it would take it off the list of controlled substances. In other words, there would be no federal criminal penalties associated with marijuana activity if the MORE Act were to pass into law. Legalization, on the other hand, usually implies some sort of regulatory scheme where you actually, like, you know, build out a framework where you where there's a regulatory market. And we didn't do that with the MORE Act. So that's why we continue to call it a decriminalization bill.
Dan, what are some of the challenges that the industry, that the legal marijuana industry face now because it's criminalized at the federal level? Like, even though states, certain states, as we said, have legalized recreational marijuana, at the federal level, there's still a charge there. So how does that work, really?
Right. So we're in this sort of a weird standoff right now between federal law and state law in those states that have legalized it. And essentially, the unspoken agreement at this point is that the feds are more or less leaving alone state-regulated industries, as long as the actors in those industries are following state law and they're not distributing the drug to minors, they're not bringing it across state lines or other sort of triggers like that. So that is sort of the state of play at this point. But the federal law makes this a very difficult business to be in. It makes banking very difficult, for example. You can't just go down to your local community bank and get a small business loan to open a dispensary. So financing has been really hard. And in turn, that makes some of these equity efforts that you alluded to more difficult. It's very difficult to help somebody from a disenfranchised community, a black or brown entrepreneur who maybe was affected by the drug war. You're trying to help that person now get a license because you've said, okay, we're going to legalize marijuana. We don't necessarily want to have all the revenue going to Wall Street. Maybe we want some of this to go to some of these communities that got hit so hard by these really heavy policing tactics, which we've now basically said we never should have been doing in the first place. When we legalize this drug, I mean, we're basically saying, you know, these activities should never have been crimes. But if you'd like that person to open up one of these businesses, the regulations are extremely onerous. These are expensive businesses to start. The security requirements, the testing requirements, it takes a lot of money to run a legal marijuana business. And if you can't get financing from traditional sources, you're at the mercy of private lenders, you know, money being loaned to you at very high interest rates. And you can imagine that the ability of somebody who's already from a disenfranchised community to access that type of money, you know, private equity, family office money, that kind of stuff, you know, if your family is not already sort of woven into that world of finance, it can be very difficult. And so that's one of the biggest restrictions that we get from having marijuana illegal at the federal level, is that inability to bank, and it makes insurance more difficult and also all sorts of things like that.
We talk a lot about the wealth gap in this country, and that's a big reason why. I mean, people need capital, you need liquid in order to, you know, create a lot of these business opportunities. And that's often something that is not in the hands of low income and many working class Americans. Maritza, turning back to the Moore Act here, we know that there's, you know, maybe it'll pass in the Senate, maybe it won't. But what's interesting here is, again, this line between legalizing and decriminalizing. Is decriminalizing, Maritza, one step toward legalizing at the federal level, or is that just a step too far right now?
Oh, I think that's the step. I mean, that's the reason that we were pushing for this bill to pass through the House. I mean, I would say that I think legalization is where we need to go. I think, you know, the government needs to be leading there, but that's not what we're seeing across the country. We see that the government is actually very much not aligned where the public is. You know, we were talking about statistics earlier, and we know that this is a really increasingly popular issue across partisan lines, across demographic lines, but it's Congress who really needs to catch up here. So, you know, decriminalization is a huge, important, significant step, but I don't think our work is done until we fully legalize. And part of that reason is because, you know, I mentioned earlier that legalization really implies building out a regulatory framework. I think if we want to build something out that's equitable, that keeps in mind people with convictions, people who have been harmed by marijuana prohibition, I think that we need to build that framework. You know, if we leave it up to the government, we know that the government often doesn't keep those individuals in mind. So, you know, for us, decriminalization was huge, but legalization is the next step for sure.
So let's talk about that, Maritza. Why is the federal government behind when it comes to public opinion on this particular issue?
That's a really good question, and it's something I think about all the time, too. You know, polling after polling indicates that this is a winning issue. The Moore Act, in fact, was supposed to come up to a floor vote for a floor vote in September. But, you know, it was all over the media that it was pulled. And the reason it was pulled was because people were, you know, kind of getting a little nervous that they were going to take a big vote like this before the election. What's funny about that is that we saw in the election that we had very successful ballot initiatives all across the country, even in states that have historically voted red or, you know, have been more conservative. So it just goes back to what we've been saying, that this really is a winning issue. I think the reason that, you know, Congress is behind on this is unfortunately just dynamics that we have to deal with here in D.C. Our government is increasingly partisan, which makes it really hard to pass any laws, even common sense laws like this, where there's a lot of popular support.
Dan, what are your thoughts on that? Why is there such a big disconnect between what the federal government or lawmakers think about the issue versus what their constituents are saying about the issue? And in fact, as you mentioned earlier, this seems to have support not just in quote unquote blue states, but also in red states and purple states. Why hasn't the federal government caught up?
I think about this all the time, too, and I actually wouldn't even limit it to just the federal government. I see this same political reluctance at all levels of government, at the municipal level, at the state level, whether elected or appointed. You know, it takes a lot of different officials from different departments working together to implement a legalization law. And certainly seen here in Massachusetts, you know, you go to local approval meetings, you know, in here in New England, we have town meetings where everyone in town sort of participates in their legislative bodies and shows up to, you know, vote on whether to like welcome a marijuana facility into their own town. But when you see these local politicians sometimes talk about this, it's like you're rewinding to the 1980s. It's like this is your brain on drugs kind of stuff. And that is often the rhetoric. And I think that that is perhaps an effect of the decades of propaganda, frankly, from the government about this subject. It's just really hard for people to conceive of a world where it's normal for politicians to say, yeah, I want to legalize marijuana. It's been very slow to break through that barrier.
Very slow. And yet we just saw Maritza, you mentioned this as part of the regulatory framework that's necessary. New Jersey just passed a regulatory framework for how it would manage recreational marijuana in the state. Are you encouraged by that, Maritza?
Yeah, I am. I think anytime we see a state, you know, turn toward legalization, I think that just gives us more momentum for what we're trying to do at the federal level. It's just another jurisdiction that we can point to and say, like, look, they did it. We should do it too. You know, I go back to, I really think the federal government needs to set some good standards and be a leader here, and they just simply haven't. We're hoping that with this vote on the MORE Act, we do move the needle some more. And, you know, another reason that we were so adamant about passing and creating the MORE Act was that we also wanted states to have a good example as they vote to loosen their marijuana laws, which most states have already done. We want them to look to the MORE Act and think about, you know, how do we decriminalize with an equity framework? We think we've got a great model for that.
Maritza, let's talk a little bit about the decriminalization here, because in order to make that a central focus, we know that Black and Brown Americans, particularly in the 80s and 90s, were heavily criminalized for marijuana possession and use. Tell us a little bit about how that has affected what we see today in terms of who's incarcerated for marijuana crimes.
Yeah, you know, I think if you haven't had contact with the criminal legal system, it might be difficult for you to imagine how a criminal conviction can impact the rest of your life. You know, what we know is that people of color in low-income communities are surveilled more, they're policed more. This means they have more contact with the criminal legal system. We also know that they experience racism literally at every level of the justice system. We know that Black and Brown individuals receive longer sentences and harsher penalties for the same crimes that white individuals commit.
And these issues have also played out in marijuana convictions?
Yes, they've also played out in marijuana convictions. The data tells us that folks are more likely to be detained and punished if they're low income, if they're a person of color, for similar crimes. And, you know, a conviction can stick with you for the rest of your life. It can affect everything, your ability to find housing, your ability to go to school. You know, the FAFSA still asks if you've ever committed a drug crime, including marijuana crimes. It could impact your ability to maintain a job and feed your family. It could even impact your ability to vote. So it really is a lifelong stain that sticks with a person for forever, really.
Sure. And we're going to be hearing from someone who had that experience on the show. But Dan, I'm wondering, is there anything in the MORE Act that talks about expungement of records and also decriminalization that ensures that many of the communities, Black and Latino communities and Indigenous communities in particular, that were hit hardest by this war on drugs, would benefit from the decriminalization of marijuana.
Right. And so, the act includes some provisions basically saying that there would be a tax on the drug at the federal level, and that some of the spoils of that would then be reinvested into some of those communities where those rates of drug arrests were really high. And here in Massachusetts, we've been pioneering like a little bit of a model about how to do this, about what fairness and equity looks like when it's baked into a licensed cannabis industry. So we here in Massachusetts, we give priority to entrepreneurs who are either directly affected, like they were arrested, or if they come from one of these communities with really high drug arrests, they get priority for licenses at the state level. And now we're also increasingly seeing some municipalities coming around, which is a very important part of the process, cities and towns that are also giving priority to those same individuals. I will say, though, that even in a state where that has been baked into the state law from the very beginning, actually implementing these policies has been a real slog, in part because of those financing issues that I mentioned, also because we've got very strong local control, and it's really has sort of ended up being a recipe for controversy and corruption at the local level. Having such strong control over who gets licenses. We've had a mayor here under federal investigation for allegedly soliciting bribes about that. We've had local officials hitting applicants up for big fees and before they can open their businesses. And all this sort of creates barriers to entry, which along with the cost of operating these businesses, getting these businesses off the ground, has really kept our industry overwhelmingly white despite some of these policies. So we really do have some work to do in terms of creating an industry that recognizes this historic unfairness.
Maritza, I have to say, I grew up in the 80s and 90s here in New York, and I recall the impact of the 1994 crime bill, the quote-unquote war on drugs. Joe Biden was one of the co-authors of that crime bill, and also war on drugs happened often under the Bill Clinton administration. And so I know how predatory a lot of these convictions, marijuana convictions, can be. And I'm wondering, for people who have done and time for marijuana, to walk around and look at how, to Dan's point, how the largely legal industry has become largely white and privileged, has to be a frustrating and deeply painful experience.
Oh, I'm very sure of that. I mean, there are people to this day who are still, serving out a criminal penalty for marijuana use. So I can't even imagine how angry and, as you said, painful that would be. This is why in the MORE Act, we made sure to divert some of the tax on the marijuana industry into different programs that would help get people with convictions, low-income folks, people who are underrepresented in the market, to help them get their footing in the industry by providing financial support, technical support, things of that nature. We think it's just an issue of plain justice that we tried to address.
Now, this bill will most likely not pass the Senate, but what does that mean for these communities, Maritza? We've just got a minute left. If we could keep that in mind, that would be great.
Yeah. So, our intention was to get this through the House and really set a marker and move the needle for a reintroduction in the next Congress. I think it's important to point out that Senator Kamala Harris is actually our lead in the Senate, and she's now the vice president-elect. So we hope that she will influence Joe Biden to support this law. So, this moves the needle, and I think it gives a lot of hope to directly impacted communities.
Maritza Perez is the director of the Office of National Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance in Washington, and Dan Adams is the cannabis reporter for the Boston Globe. Maritza and Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks,
Danzina.
And we're continuing our look at recreational marijuana legalization. And who's really benefiting from these policy changes? As we heard from our last two guests, the millions of people in the United States with prior marijuana-related convictions are rarely the ones who profit off of legalization.
My name is Ingrid Archie, and I am the Civic Engagement Coordinator for a New Way of Life Reentry Project located in Los Angeles, California.
In 2004, Ingrid was convicted of possession with intent to sell marijuana.
I did 17 months on a 3-year sentence. When I came home, I was sent to a program for behavior modification because of my charges. And after I finished the behavior modification program, I went into a program called A New Way of Life, which was transitional housing. Once I left A New Way of Life, I was able to obtain a job working for a company that did third-party kind of consulting work with other organizations. And so because the company I worked for had a contract with Verizon, they decided to change their hiring practices for people with backgrounds. And even though I was upfront and honest from the beginning about what was on my background, I was fired because I had the marijuana conviction on my record. And it made it hard for me to find another job for the next 7 years.
4 years ago, Ingrid worked to get Proposition 64 passed in California. The law legalized recreational marijuana in the state, but Ingrid was more concerned with the criminal justice overhauls that came with it.
Proposition 64 in 2016 came about, and we did the work at A New Way of Life around education as far as the criminalization of marijuana in our communities during the war on drugs and how it really sent a lot of our community members to prison. And it was important that we voted for Prop 64 to pass because our people would come home. And I understand Prop 64 was a lot bigger than just people coming home. You know, it was about the legalization of marijuana and so on and so forth. But for our community, because our community was hit hardest regarding the criminalization of marijuana, we needed our community members to understand that it was imperative that our people come home and be able to get a fresh start.
But that fresh start rarely includes making a living in the recreational marijuana industry.
The legalization of marijuana in California is kind of like a gold rush. It's lucrative. It's something that has been basically waiting around for so long. And for people who already had a stake in it, if you had money, you were able to invest in what we have now with the marijuana gold rush. The people who have the money never really felt the ravages that our communities still feel and that we still see when, you know, we go to poor communities that were hit hard by marijuana criminalization. You know, they never felt that, but our community members did. And although they got freed, but they're still locked out of a system that people are like literally making money off of, millions of dollars off of. And our people are still locked out of it. And so, no, I don't think that there is enough being done to make sure that the people who are hardest hit by this are able to make an income.
Ingrid Archie is a legal clinic coordinator with A New Way of Life, a Los Angeles nonprofit supporting formerly incarcerated women. We wanted to hear your thoughts on the legalization of recreational marijuana, and it looks like many of you feel that marijuana should be legalized and that the people who've been convicted of weed offenses or charged with crimes related to marijuana should be compensated in one form or another.
I am in my mid-20s and I've been a recreational marijuana user since I was 18, started in college. I do think that the legalization is good. I think marijuana has been used to criminalize people in unfair ways throughout its history of interaction with the law. But I also am a little bit worried that a lot of the companies that have popped up are taking advantage of the new market and taking advantage of things that were meant for small businesses and to keep local weed farms alive. So yeah, mixed feelings.
I'm Ruthie Wilson from Cocoa Beach, Florida. I've been a medical professional for over 40 years, and I grew up in the heyday of drugs, sex, and rock and roll. However, I never smoked pot, and yet I feel that we should legalize marijuana and should have years and years ago, because maybe people who are addicted to alcohol, cigarettes, and narcotics would be using this drug, which has more benefits than drawbacks, medically, physically, and emotionally. We can empty out our prisons. We're 5% of the world's population, and yet we hold 20%.
Linda from Brookline, right next to Boston. I do smoke pot. I have used other drugs, including heroin and cocaine, rock and powder. I think we should make all drugs legal. I think that African Americans, who are the ones who spend all the time in jail to sell in pot, me as a white person got to smoke or other drugs I bought, was always blacks taking the hit for it and going to jail. And now white people are running it all. And the taxes are all going to white people. It stinks.
This is Ursula Smith. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I do not smoke marijuana. I am really so sad about all the people of color that have been in jail for selling marijuana when now all these states are now making it free. And I think all those records should be expunged, and anybody who has been in jail for marijuana possession or distribution should be compensated.
This conversation around legalizing marijuana is a great example of how Black and brown people are incarcerated right now, pursuing the only profitable business that was in their communities for the last 50 years. If we want to legalize marijuana, we need to free all Black and brown people that were just trying to feed their families.
My name's Craig, calling from Langhorne, PA. I support recreational use and the taxation, as well as the production and use of hemp and hemp products and declassification of those. They were used widely in the 1800s. Apparently, it became a conflict of capitalistic interest, and hemp was outlawed, and marijuana turned into an evil thing. But the tax breaks would be great, and just like a state store, you never saw a mad pothead, but you see plenty of angry drunks.
My name is Ricky. I'm calling from Titusville, Florida. I support a complete and full decriminalization of marijuana, as well as an expungement of all nonviolent offenses in relation to it. Prior to living in Florida, I lived in a legal state, and I saw the benefits financially and industrially of the growth and tax money that was brought in by it, as well as the good that the loosened social stigma around marijuana use did for communities of color.
Hi, my name's, and then I'm not even going to say it because I'm a registered nurse, and I really support the legalization of cannabis across the board. It's better than alcohol to recreate with, and there's over 100 and some odd cannabinoids, THC and CBD are two of them. We need to do research, figure out what they are so we can use them as medicine.
Thanks so much for sharing your stories with us. And we want to keep hearing from you, so call us at 877-869-8253. We'll have more on this topic tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
And now for some breaking news.
What a fabulous battle that was! And Ram is our first ever Youth Olympic champion.
That's the sound from the 2018 Youth Olympic Games, the first year in which breakdancing, or breaking, appeared at the Games. Now, as of this week, breaking has been declared an official Olympic sport, set to appear in the 2024 Paris Games. For many, this is a sign of a deeper appreciation of breaking throughout the world. To others, it could signal a watering down and a co-opting of a sport with deep roots. Here to give us their thoughts are two legendary figures in breaking history. Michael Holman is a New York-based artist, writer, filmmaker, and historian. He created the New York City Breakers and the first hip-hop TV show, Graffiti Rock. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Ken Swift, a second-generation B-boy and former vice president of the Rocksteady Crew. Ken is considered to be one of the people with the greatest influence on breakdancing. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I just want to say, as I mentioned, I grew up in New York City in the 80s, and so I watched the evolution of breaking. I'm not a breaker myself, but I watched it. It was amazing. And to see this moment, to me, was kind of surprising. What did each of you feel when you heard about the decision? Michael?
Well, actually, in 1983, as I was the manager and choreographer for the New York City Breakers, and we were doing all kinds of shows on television, and one of them was the NBC Salute to the Olympics. And it occurred to me at that time that breakdancing was going to become an Olympic sport. It just kind of popped into my head, and I actually wrote a proclamation. All the New York City Breakers signed it, and I put it in my book that came out in 1984 with rules and regulations that would go along with a competition like that. So actually, I was kind of prescient and was, I think, the first person to predict that this would happen.
So now that it's happened, are you happy about it, Michael?
I am. I mean, I know that there are a lot of cautionary thoughts involved. For example, there's the obvious debate about whether breaking should be a sport at all. There's always been for generations people arguing that it was an art form and it was a dance and it wasn't a sport and it shouldn't be seen that way. But, you know, breaking was born in competition. It was born in the battle, and it developed and matured in battle, in break battles. So I think that as a competitive sport, it's a natural for breaking.
Ken, what about you? What were your thoughts when you heard about this breaking competition that we're expected to see in 2024 in Paris?
Well, the interesting connection with Michael and myself is that he was actually the manager of the New York City Breakers, Floor Masters, and as a member of Rocksteady Crew, we were in those circles, we were in those battles, those wars, in the East Village and anywhere else we could. So that needs to be noted. And I do remember when Michael had this whole idea. Me personally, I was on the side. I couldn't figure it. I didn't get it because I grew up with sports and I was very athletic. Me and my older brothers, tons of trophies, love sports, love the Olympics. But, you know, there was something different that happened to me to connect with a circle in a park with music playing and this energy. It was different than sports for me. So I don't really see breaking as a sport. I never played, had music playing to the beat while I was dribbling a basketball. I never, you know, we have Olympics, but it's called hip hop culture. So, I mean, we have a DJ that, you know, provides the beats. And this is the experience I have. So I'm not against the Olympics. I think it's great. I was contacted 5 years ago to be on these boards, and a lot of people from different federations were reaching me. And there was something inside of me that was just like, I'm actually responsible to a full world community of hip hop culture. So kind of like opted out of it, you know, but I just don't think it's a sport. I think it's an art. And that's because of the streets and where I come from. That's the way I feel that way.
Ken, let's talk about the streets and where and what that looked like for people who, I feel like what's interesting to me as a Gen Xer is watching how the generations that were transformative to me are now considered retro and cool. And so I think breaking falls into that. What was it really like back in the day? And Michael, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. What was breaking like back in the original New York City iteration of it? Ken, what was your experience?
Well, I mean, like I said, I was into sports. You know, I have my mom raised me and my brothers, and sports was a huge part of our lives. You know, like all through the week, we would have to get out the house. We couldn't stay home. We had to get out in the summers. And then on the weekends, we were part of a sports league, and it was everything to us. And you know, that's the way we occupied our time at that time. Now, when I was exposed to the first kind of images I saw and these situations that I ran into, were like, they were mind blowing. You know, like at first I would see these kids flipping on 100th Street and Central Park. There was a sand park there, and these black kids was lined up in this long, long, long line of concrete, and just one by one, run real fast and just round off somersaults and do all these crazy flips. And I was like, it blew my mind, you know, and that was around 77. And then in 78, three blocks to the left of that, I saw this, there was music playing and it was dark, and, you know, went in there and, you know, saw this circle and became a spectator and went and tried to peek my face in and saw some of the same black kids I saw flipping. They were dancing, they were breaking in this circle. And, there was no security. It was just like this gathering, and it was kind of like the secret language, this underground kind of thing. And I was intimidated, and I was like, but at the same time was completely intrigued by it. And at the time I was also, you know, like riding dirt bikes and doing crazy stunts. And I was 12 years old. I was a daredevil, you know, but at the time it was also, you know, I didn't know if I was allowed to jump in and do something, because it was very intimidating in a sense. And it took, you know, a couple of more times of going to these spaces to see that I knew people. And then I started getting, you know, developing relationships, and then developed the courage. And from that point on, it just became my life.
Michael, how has breaking evolved since the time that Ken is talking about, and the times that you and I guess the three of us all kind of remember this being a street competition, a dance form, something that people would whip out, you know, little squares of linoleum and just spin on? Like, where are we today from where we were then?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It started out as a dance that was all about one-upsmanship and battling and doing moves, original moves that someone else had never seen before. But it was very dance oriented. It's very music oriented. I always remember the Rocksteady crew, and especially Ken, being amazing dancers and being all about the rhythm and style. And at an event, I had a club called Negril. I had with Cool Lady Blue down in the East Village, down in your neck of the woods, back in the early 80s. And I had this opportunity of bringing the whole Zulu Nation throwdown, including Rocksteady Crew, to perform for an East Village crowd. And at that time, it was considering what it is today, it would have been considered quite rudimentary and not terribly stylistic or athletic. But great dancing and great sense of music. That's what Rocksteady Crew brought to the game. And then I asked Crazy Legs, listen, you know, it really would be great if you would bring another crew down to battle so that this East Village crowd could see a B-boy battle. And so they had befriended another crew uptown called the Floor Masters, and they decided, okay, let's bring the Floor Masters down to perform a battle in front of an East Village crowd. And that was when I first saw power moves. And I think that the Floor Masters, what Rocksteady Crew had in dance and in style and smooth beat and smooth moves, the Floor Masters had power and speed. And I was so attracted to this athletic thing. And so
About Floor Masters, you're talking about what? Like, these are the people who are doing what's known as windmills and all of these floor moves, right, on the ground, right?
Exactly. These are moves on the ground, windmills, backspins. And it's very interesting because Ken is talking about, he's really kind of identified a in one moment an evolution of dance where the early first iteration of b-boying or breaking were mostly black kids doing a lot of moves, gymnastics moves, but they were mostly on their feet and doing flips and whatnot. And it was really the Puerto Rican kids who took it to the next level of gymnastics, all these amazing moves that, again, take gyroscopic skill. And they took it to the next level in the later 70s and early 80s. And then people like myself, Fab Five Freddy, Charlie Ahern, Martha Cooper, Henry Chalfant, were these people downtown in the art world bringing hip-hop culture downtown to expose it to our contemporaries and friends. And what happened was the rest of the world, vis-a-vis BBC, Canal Plus in France, NHK Tokyo, they would see these events happening at Negril, the club downtown, and then it spread all over the world. And 20, 30 years later, the dance changed from what it was in the early 80s, to this incredible acrobatic gymnastic thing that it is today just because of the competition, when you've got Russians and Chinese and Koreans and Brazilians and with all of their cultural influences coming in, the dance just kept evolving and evolving and evolving to where it is today. And if you really, honestly, if you look at some of the best moves that Ken Swift or Powerful Pexter of the New York City Breakers was doing in the early 80s compared to what you see today, it is kind of, I mean, ask Ken, but I think it's almost night and day. And it's, wow, the amount of evolution that happened is just almost shocking.
With that evolution and with this becoming an international phenomenon over the course of the years, Michael, as you just described, I'm wondering, Ken, is this also a business? And has it evolved into a business where people are professional breakers are able to make a living, where this new Olympic sport, if you will enable that further? I mean, where do you see this going in terms of the business element of it?
Well, it's important to understand that we are approaching 50 years since the birth of hip hop culture. And that 50 year period will come right before 2024. And what we've done since the 70s is we've built a world community with this art form. We've sustained it. We figured out a way to do it in the early years with no money. Jams happened. People made it happen because of the passion behind the experience. So we carried this dance and this art form around the world, of course, with those opportunities in the 80s to travel and the films and so forth. And it did become I leaned more towards teaching and education as my journey progressed. And it provided me opportunities to see the world and perform and do all types of interesting art with breaking. And it did establish these world events that still go on to this day, these huge world championships that provide opportunities. Now, the financing was always an issue. This is roller coaster, this roller coaster ride of how do you get the money? Who gets the money? What country is going to give you money? You know what I'm saying? So worldwide experiencing this for the last 40 years, I'm just like looking at it and I'm saying, well, you know, there are struggles within it. And one thing I know that this is the community that I'm a part of. You know what I'm saying? And it does provide dancers opportunities to win battles. Now, the mentality changes a little bit when people want money, you know, and, you know, the attitude started leaning towards, well, how much is the battle? I'm not going to enter if it's, you know, people were thinking about money to enter these battles. So, you know, within the evolution of the dance form itself, the mentality has also changed a lot because people get older, you know, and people got bills and you got to pay rent. And, you know, like a lot of dancers were concerned on that level. So I think that a lot of people are leaning in the direction of thinking that the Olympics is going to change all that. And once again, it's just every 4 years. Every 4 years this happens. But within them 4 years, it's like hundreds of jams around the world. So I don't know the business side of it, but I know that the Olympics is a business.
Yeah, and also, I'm just to that point. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, the music that accompanied breaking, I should say, back in the day, almost felt symbiotic, right? Like everything just felt like it went hand in hand with the moves, went in hand in hand with the music went in hand with the moves. Some of that was happening in the moment because DJs were responding to breakers were responding to DJs. Hip hop itself has evolved significantly since those days of what we would call the golden era or the beginning of hip hop. Has that connection remained, Ken? Has music influencing, you know, the way that hip hop has evolved, has breaking evolved with it? Or are they still a symbiotic sort of, you know, relationship, or are they two separate things now?
Well, there's generations, you know, there's new dancers that appeal to new music, you know, and there's a lot of new dancers that can identify with 70s funk and soul. But there is a world underground community that is conscious of this. There's a love of music within the whole world community where when the opportunities are there for, you know, to spin records and DJ after parties and DJ battles, you know, you're going to still have the tradition flowing through it. Now, the other end of this evolution of music and also, you know, people producing music, you know, so there's a mix, there's a new blend of new kind of approach to music engineering and production. And a lot of that vinyls, you know, it's those, you know, James Brown and the music, you know, that defined that era and the dance itself, you know, we have to wait and see how, if that's going to be considered and if it's going to be respected, you know, because I believe in the vinyl. I believe the vinyl is a part of the tradition, and not only the words of these songs, the beats of these songs, but the words combined. These songs were pivotal in uplifting people in the 70s, you know. So when you feel this music, you listen to the lyrics, it's inspiring in a sense. And there's a lot more music that's being produced where there are no lyrics. And a lot of times they're not allowing DJs to play the actual records. So time will tell how this is going to affect the dancer. But I think a lot of young dancers really love the music that's being produced. I can't identify that well because I come from a different generation. So each generation is going to kind of like really lean towards what they like. And some people are going to like the older stuff and some people aren't. So time will tell.
And finally, Michael, will this dilute breaking in terms of bringing it to the Olympics? Will it dilute the soul of breaking?
Well, I hope not. I mean, that's an important thing. That's something to be mindful of. I mean, Thomas Bach of the International Olympic Committee actually said, in quote, he wants the Summer Games to be more gender balanced, more youthful, and more urban. So he's recognizing the Black and Puerto Rican influence of the original dancers, New York dancers that created breaking or b-boying, and he wants to embrace that. And I just hope that we can get more American sponsors and American corporations, the American government, to support breakers, American breakers in the Olympics, the way that other countries, governments and corporations are supporting dancers from different countries. We just don't have that type of support. And if I could just mention one thing about that Ken mentioned about music and the importance of music. One important challenge for the Olympics in terms of keeping it soulful, keeping the dance soulful, is being able to play original break beats, songs like James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose Live, or Jimmy Castor Bunch Just Begun. And a lot of dancers will have been raised on this kind of music and inspired by this kind of music. But then the publishing rights to actually play that kind of music on international television can be prohibitive. So that's a real challenge right there. And I'm hoping that there's a corporation out there, maybe YouTube or maybe Universal Music, that would foot the bill so that dancers in the Olympics can dance to original tracks as opposed to music that's made just because it's inexpensive and was made just for this event. And it sounds kind of like the original music. And secondly, in terms of it maintaining its soul, my biggest concern, even though I was sort of predicting this back in the early 80s, my biggest concern had always been when breaking enters the Olympics is it going to be co-opted by gymnastics? Will it, because the music isn't right and because the judging isn't what we'd like it to be, and because the dancers have continued to be more and more and more athletic, gymnastics oriented, are they losing style? Are they losing the dance? Are they not listening to the music when they hit certain beats in the dance? Are they conscious of the music? Are they dancing to the music? Is the music important? Because sport or not, this is a dance. And unless breaking can maintain its purity and its style, it could possibly be co-opted and it could possibly lose its soul. It needs to maintain its the musical connection. It needs to maintain itself as a dance and not just a bunch of gymnastics moves, which there's a danger of. And it needs to be able to use those original tracks if that's what dancers want.
Michael Holman is a New York-based artist, writer, filmmaker, and historian, and he created the New York City Breakers and the first hip-hop TV show, Graffiti Rock. And Ken Swift is a second-generation B-boy and former vice president of the Rocksteady Crew. Michael and Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Hope you all enjoyed the Wednesday Weed Talk. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.